members of Commonwealth, Betsy Weston, and Highlands Council, William E. Winter, Jr., Assistant Attorney General for the Commonwealth.
You may proceed.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Seth Weston. I represent Mr. John Thomas. This case is very similar to one the court just heard of Mr. Harvey. I'm alleging that statute 37.2913 is unconstitutional because Mr. Thomas, as it is written, no respondent, including Mr. Thomas, gets an expert, whether retained or not, to assist him when his liberty is at stake and the Commonwealth is seeking to put him back in the VCBR for continued treatment or to consider whether to release him, because that is the question, should he go back or not. But well, the reason...
Excuse me. There's nothing in the statute to prevent a judge from using his discretion to appoint an expert.
Yes, sir, and I made that argument in the trial court. That is correct. Nothing says it can't, but as it's written, it doesn't allow it. It just says the Commonwealth gets one.
Well, it doesn't prohibit it.
It does not prohibit it.
It's not a matter of not allowing it. It's just simply you don't get one by statute. But nonetheless, as you've heard from the prior argument, the judge does have the discretion to apply one, to appoint one.
He does. In fact, the judge in this case gave me a toxicologist as an expert. But the very argument that he could appoint one, I suggest, goes to the very root of the problem and the constitutionality for an indigent person. Because, as the evidence is in my case, that Mr. Thomas would have hired an expert had he had the funds, he could not, and then the judge said no. So a wealthy person could have bought an expert, retained an expert, I should say, and have that person assist him when his liberty is at stake. And in this case, these cases, while the initial review is 6 months after he gets the VCBR, he could be in there for the rest of his life. And importantly, to get out again requires two experts. At every stage but this one, the statute requires two experts. And that's because I submit to the court because of ACCI. ACCI, I submit, applies to these cases. And if you read the ACCI, it's all about psychological assistance. And that's because we're talking about opinions of doctors of psychological issues. It's not like DNA or math where 2 plus 2 equals 4. The very danger of psychological analysis is that opinions differ. Exactly what the Supreme Court said in ACCI. That's why you need a second expert.
But even under ACCI, you have to show particularized need. So just because there's a psychologist, does that mean any time the Commonwealth has a psychologist of any kind, you automatically get your own psychologist?
No, sir. In this case in particular, we're talking about a recommitment of a sexually violent predator, and the issue in these cases is always the psychological assessment of this person based upon whatever the factors are that are causing the revocation, whether it's a drug issue or whatever.
When you read these reports, I mean, it'd be one thing to say, well, I administered this particular test, that goes by a certain name, and I scored it a certain way. And the argument is, well, that's the wrong test, or you scored it, the variables incorrectly. It's a very technical kind of argument. And so maybe in that instance you say, well, look, I need my own, I'm a lawyer, I'm not training this stuff. I need my own expert to help me digest all this stuff and challenge a government expert. But if it's something like, well, you're disobeying the instructions, you're not showing up on time, you're defiant, you're recalcitrant, whatever. So, yeah, it's a psychological expert, but then why is that showing a particularized need to say, no, that's not what's going on, he had these other stressors in his life, I mean, whatever. So I'm trying to figure out, in your case, where's the showing of particularized need?
In reading through ACCI, that ACCI itself gives you the particularized need. Husky is a very enforcing of ACCI here in Virginia, but ACCI gives you the particularized need. It says, when a psychological opinion...
So, it sounds like your answer is, you got a psychological expert automatically, because of the nature of the enterprise, it's psychology, I automatically get my own expert.
For these revocation cases, that's what I'm arguing, yes, sir.
Okay.
For these revocation cases, because it's not just like a criminal probation violation where, hey, you didn't report into probation officer not in on the control, you skipped this meeting, you didn't go through drug court. These, any witness can testify to that. These require an expert to give analysis of a doctor's opinion. And as you just mentioned, the analysis is there's some what's called static factors. And that is things that can't change, the age of the person and some other issues. And then there's dynamic factors. Every single report, every single opinion by a psychologist in these cases combines those two. The dynamic factors change, and the psychologist attributes significance that he believes appropriate to the dynamic factors that can change, and then makes an opinion. And under ACCI, that's what the Supreme Court literally counseled, is you must have caution.
Help me out with this,
because yes,
I honestly, I'm stuck on this. I can't figure out what the two of you are saying. This man has, your client and the previous client, has been found to be a sexually violent predator, right?
Yes, sir.
And there's no due process, there's no due process violation asserted to that finding. He has been adjudicated this way. He his rights, his liberty, his capacity to rejoin the community have already been taken from him by proper statutory due process with proper evidence. The only question in these cases is not whether he's a violent predator, but whether or not you can mitigate his violent sexual predation by putting him in an inpatient thing versus an outpatient thing. Give me a court of authority that says that in an emergency custody context with someone who's already been adjudicated to be a sexually violent predator, that the choice of inpatient versus outpatient treatment requires the government to pay for experts for this sexually violent predator at every one of these six-month, year, emergency hearings, every one of these hearings. I mean, I don't see any authority for that. I see the logical argument. I just don't see any authority. So help me out.
I'll deal with the review when he's in BCBR. A second opinion is required even if the Commonwealth says he should be released.
I agree with that, and I think that actually hurts your argument because the statute builds in the protection. But one of the places that doesn't worry about it is these emergency things. Why should due process step in and say, look, if you're only moving him from a community-based rehab to an inpatient-based rehab, oh my gosh, that change in status for someone adjudicated a sexually violent predator is so significant that the U.S. Constitution requires experts to be appointed in every case, watered down particularized need to mean anything, and basically have full-blown evidentiary hearings every single step in this process. Assuming that's a good way of doing it, show me some case that says we have to do it. Otherwise, you've got to persuade us that we should go on our own and do it.
I would submit ACCI requires a court to do it, and that's because I don't know of a case that says.
I'm asking for a case that talks about a sexually violent predator who's been already adjudicated, and the question is not his liberty. The question is inpatient, outpatient. That's the question these psychologists and these psychiatrists are trying to figure out.
I don't know of a case that applies. I believe these are. This might be the first time this court's considering it, but the issue is the exact same. And what happens, either he goes in or he stays out, but the issue is his psychological makeup
in
at the time of the hearing.
Was there any adjudication that he was guilty of anything? That he had any liberty interest that had been procedurally, constitutionally deprived of him? As opposed to this gentleman, who's already been found to be a sexually violent predator.
In ACCI, the issue was sanity.
Right. He was presumed innocent, and he had not had any liberty interest taken from him, except, of course, pretrial detention. Actually, that's not a bad analogy, too. Does that mean in pretrial detentions, ACCI requires in the bail hearings to have evidence presented from experts?
No, sir, because the criminal cases are different than this. The criminal cases can be, as I said, you didn't report to the probation office, you're not calling me back, other issues that a non-expert can testify to. In this case,
the issue... I presided myself over probation hearings where psychological testimony was quite relevant.
It may be relevant, but it's not required. It's required in these cases because the issue is, does he have a mental defect that makes him likely to commit a sexually violent offense? There's a danger to the community. What's the psychological makeup is always the question in these cases. And the government gets an expert to say what that is, and he needs to be committed again, while a respondent can't have one to say, as in this case, what Dr. King opined, I think he may be able to stay out. He's got a drug addiction problem. He should be able to stay out.
My last question, and if I'm wrong, I need you to show me why I'm wrong. I'm asking myself, is that the question at all? He's been adjudicated a sexually violent predator. That's a pretty powerful adjudication. The man is a predator, he's violent, and he's sexually violent. And the victims of the Commonwealth anticipate that the government's going to protect him from that. The question in an emergency custody hearing is, can the psychiatrist deal with it, with the inpatient, deal with it with the outpatient? What's the best interest for him as well as his potential victims? Isn't that the only issue in the emergency custody hearing?
Yes, sir. Whether he presents an undue risk to the public to leave him out for treatment or to put him in VCBR.
It's a treatment modality. It's not, adjudicating him anything. It's simply inpatient versus outpatient, the kind of judgments that actually probation courts are making all the time in other contexts.
I disagree that that may come up in a probation violation, but it's a different nature of a case. This is about a doctor saying outpatient does not present an undue risk to the public such that he should be committed again. A doctor has to give him a psychological assessment of this person. That's the very nature of this case, and that's at issue in a revocation hearing.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you. Keep on.
So I had stated, and I rely upon my brief as written, that the statute is facially invalid because it doesn't give anybody, any respondent, the ability to present such evidence, although at every other stage, when his liberty is at issue.
Where is that argument preserved in the trial?
It was not facial,
on constitution as opposed to the Aki point.
It was not, Your Honor. When I went to do the brief, I realized I had not made those arguments when I was trying to articulate what this constitutional issue was better for the brief. I realized that is the issue. It's either as applied or it's facially. So I'm asking the court to take it up under the ends of justice under 525 because that's the issue. And I missed it in trial court. My client won't have to be penalized for that. But I raised the constitutional issue. And that is the issue. It's either it's facially, and that's a very hard argument to make under the case laws, or it's as applied. And I suggest it's both, because as applied to him, he didn't get one, but he got a toxicologist because he tested positive for drugs. And the issue was, can he stay out given a drug addiction? Is there a drug addiction? That's another psychological assessment. And should he be then put back into VCBR? And Dr. King was able, he had been involved in the case, was able to give a slight opinion that, well, I need to obviously interview him to do a doctor's assessment, but what I know about the case and his drug addiction, I think he may be able to stay out, and I proffered that evidence. And I'm sorry, I see I did not ask to reserve time. I'll ask to reserve the balance of the time.
All right.
May it please the Court. William Winters for the Commonwealth. Your Honor, the appellant here argues that he should get a psychologist because opinions can differ. It's not like an exact science. But actually, that's why there's less need for him to actually have psychological assistance in this, because the opinions in these cases are not dispositive. And that's been shown by the court's prior affirmations of the trial court, such as in the Squire case, where there were two expert opinions who testified that the respondent, Squire, was a sexually violent predator. The trial court still found that he was not a sexually violent predator, and this court affirmed that finding. Noting that the expert opinions are not dispositive.
How many cases have we had where there was only one expert and we said, well, that's not dispositive?
At least the Jackson case. That was actually at the probable cause hearing, and that was before, and I'll be very honest here, because in Jackson, that was at a probable cause stage, and the court noted that the respondent in that case, his right to have expert assistance for the trial phase had not yet matured under 37.2-907, because it's only after probable cause is shown.
So we didn't look at the substance of the expert's opinion. We simply said that the expert in Jackson, and you need to re-educate me on that, did not deal with the substance of the opinion in that case.
It did. I mean, the trial court had dismissed the case, found that there was not probable cause that Jackson was a sexually violent predator, and this court affirmed that. Saying that, the expert's opinion, even at the probable cause stage where the level of evidence is so low, is not dispositive.
Okay. Are there any cases of which you're aware where there was one expert and the fact finder, or this case, this court as the reviewer of the fact finder, said, appreciate that expert's opinion, but this court is not going to follow it? I'm just looking to see if there's case law support for the argument you're making.
Where there was just one expert?
Yeah.
Where the trial court just said he's not going to follow the opinions?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think Squire goes beyond that because there were two experts who said he is a sexually violent predator. I mean, Squire did not have a respondent testify on his behalf. There were two experts for the Commonwealth, so more than one testifying against Squire that he's a sexually violent predator. The trial court said, it's not clear and convincing evidence in this court affirmed.
That answers my question.
I mean, a defendant's not helpless. A defendant has a power of cross-examination to point out, this is the basis on which you say he needs to go inpatient, but isn't it a fact and whatever. I mean, it's just like any expert, whether it's DNA, tool marks, firearms, toxicology, you name it, if there are flaws in the expert's opinion, those can be exposed to cross-examination. So even assuming you're going to extend Aki to this discrete situation, you still, it seems to me, you would still need to show particularized need for an expert as opposed to the ordinary vehicle for challenging the expert opinion.
That's right, and that's why it's just, what the respondent presents here is not a particularized need. It presents a general want. Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, the court said, and Aki made clear, in this court also in Husk, that just because something is beneficial doesn't mean that a criminal defendant in trial is even entitled to it, much less a respondent in one of these civil commitment cases. Maybe having another psychologist to assist you, that might be beneficial, but it's not a need. In order to prevail in the case against him, because there are, as the court noted, many other procedural protections, the right to have counsel, the right to cross-examine witnesses, and the right to have a hearing, a fair notice of that hearing. And that's shown even empirically by the history of this very case, which was considered before.
May I interject there? Am I right that Dr. Miller had previously issued a report saying, I think he's ready, put him on conditional, I don't think he's ready, don't put him on conditional release, the situation you have, but the trial court nonetheless went the other way?
Yes, there were actually two prior hearings. I mean, within 3 years, there were three emergency custody orders on Thomas. The first time, Dr. Miller opined that Thomas was suitable to return to conditional release.
And the trial court didn't do that.
No. Yeah, in the Commonwealth agreed. We released him by an agreed order.
Oh,
we said we cannot meet our burden of proof. Dr. Miller opines that he's suitable to return to conditional release. We released him back on conditional release.
What happened in the second case?
In the second case, as you mentioned, the second emergency custody order hearing proceeding is when Dr. Miller said, this time he's not suitable to return to conditional release. We had a hearing. The Commonwealth took the position that he should be committed, and yet the trial court said no. Don't find sufficient evidence
so
that he
instance,
be committed,
Miller
and
was
released
testifying,
him on conditional.
His opinion was testifying in favor of Mr. Thomas.
The first time it was, yes, and that's why the Commonwealth agreed to go ahead and re-release him.
Okay.
Which also is why that this is, the appellant argues that the fact that there's a psychologist involved, it's almost a burden against him, that therefore he should have an expert appointed to assist him in combating the common psychologist. But actually, the fact that his mental state or psychology suitability for conditional release is an issue and an element to be proven by the Commonwealth is actually a protection on the respondent in these cases and on Thomas, because it's another burden that the Commonwealth has to prove. I mean, this isn't just like, as Your Honor's noted earlier, and the appellant, just a probation violation hearing. We can't say, he was late to an appointment, or he tested positive for drugs. We can't just go in and say, well, that's enough. He should be committed. There's actually this additional element that the Commonwealth has the burden of proving, and every element the Commonwealth has to prove is protection on the respondent. And the Commonwealth has to prove that not only did he violate the condition of his release, but because of that violation, he's no longer suitable to return to conditional release. So in that sense, it's more of a protection on a respondent.
One of the Commonwealth's arguments is that these experts are more neutral. In other words, we don't go hunting for the best expert who's the most hardline pro-government expert. We're just stuck with whoever we get. But does the record or regulations or something show that? In other words, I mean, it's still a government agency that's picking these folks. And granted, it's different than the prosecution side, but it's still the government. And so, I mean, how do we, and there may be some merit to that, that this is different than the government cherry-picking someone who's going to say exactly what we want them to say. But that's an assertion. Where can we find that is, in fact, the case? I mean, are there regulations that establish that? Are there policies we can find somewhere that lay that out?
I know under the statute, or under the Act, there is, I mean, certain qualifications for right. The experts. I mean, obviously, they have to meet.
In other words, suppose you have an expert who is always, you know, viewed as pro-defendant or whatever, who's, oh, no, the community is fine. And eventually they just weed him out because we, you know, well, he's the wrong guy. We're going to pick these other ones. I mean, it's just on this record, it's hard, you know, it's hard to know, you know, trust us, we're the government and we're picking neutral experts.
Right.
I'm just trying to figure out where I can support that or refute that or whatever.
Well, I mean, my one empirical example is the history of this case, as I mentioned earlier.
Understood.
Where Dr. Miller,
yeah,
on the first emergency custody order hearing had opined that that Mr. Thomas was suitable to return to conditional release. So he's not, you know, they're not, the expert's opinion is not beholden to the Commonwealth to find that they, you know, need to be committed. But as far as the policy, I mean, I know there's certain criteria that has to be met. I mean, the statute under 37.2-913 shows that, you know, the Department of Behavioral Health designates the expert. So that's the agency that does it. Throughout the other statutes, it talks about that they have to be a licensed clinical psychologist or psychiatrist who are experienced in sex offender treatment. And but as far as, you know, that selection process, I'm not sure if there's anything in the statute specifically that discusses, you know.
Yeah, I just didn't know if there were, like, you know, sometimes agencies will put various policy things on the, you know, this is how we operate, or there's regulations that sort of implement the statute that say this is how we operate.
And there very might well be something from the Department of Behavioral Health that might be publicly available. I'm just not sure. Because
that's
I'm
fine.
Not involved in that part of the selection of that.
Understood.
On
yeah.
it. So,
does anything in statute preclude Mr. Thomas from making a request of the court not to appoint Dr. Miller for these matters? Because in his instance, Mr. Thomas claims the expert's truly not neutral. Is there anything that precludes the court from hearing that and saying, well, I don't know if that's true or not, but I'll appoint Dr. Jones instead of Dr. Miller if that's the argument?
Right. There's nothing in the statute that precludes that. Of course, though, I would note that...
But I guess the point is not applied here, but if the statute does not preclude that, isn't that the appropriate way to adjust the due process concerns, I'll use that expression, to the narrow context of an emergency custody order proceeding?
I'm not sure. I think because Anki specifically says that, and this court in Husky, that a respondent or criminal defendant does not have a right to an expert of his own choosing. I think that implies that, you know, they don't get to kind of curb or direct the court into things. I think the due process protection in that case...
True, but you know, in any sort of trial court criminal proceeding, if the suggested expert is challenged by either of the parties, the Commonwealth or the defendant, the court has the discretion to say, well, I don't need to make any factual findings about this one expert. There's 10 other people on the list. I'll appoint someone else. Why wouldn't that be a safety valve for all the concerns that have been expressed about, well, this particular expert is testifying on behalf of the government too much?
Right. Well, I think the appropriate due process protection is the right to cross-examine that witness and draw out any bias. You know, is he pro government, pro commitment, uncommitting respondents?
And you can call other evidence too. I mean, if the argument is, well, you were late, and then the answer is, well, but you know, I got to take three different buses, and sometimes it snows, and whatever. I mean, so it's more than just cross examination. It's just attacking the factual foundation, perhaps, of the expert.
Right, and so since there's two elements the Commonwealth has to prove, a respondent has two fronts to fight on, and that would be why, in this case, you know, Mr. Thomas had asked for a toxicologist. He wanted, for the toxicologist, that didn't have to do with the conditional release violation. He wanted to attack the violation aspect itself. I mean, not whether he's suitable for conditional release or has to be committed. So, yes, I mean, that's one thing that can be, you know, that they can prevail on where they don't need any psychologist at all, just the facts of whether there was a violation or whether that was sufficient. I mean, here Thomas can argue that, you know, his cocaine, his positive test result for cocaine was a false positive, which is why he asked the trial judge to appoint him a expert toxicologist as well.
Let me ask you this. There's been some question as to the Attorney General's position concerning the application of AAQI to emergency custody proceedings. Do you believe that the trial court erred in appointing a toxicologist in this sense?
I do not think that the particularized need was met. I argue that at the trial court level, but because it's within the abuse of discretion standard, we wouldn't feel that it would be worth appealing.
But do you have the position that because AAQI doesn't apply, he'd never be entitled to a toxicologist or any other expert?
I think that right, the level that applies is difficult to say there. It's that's certainly the analysis or framework we have, and a sexual violent predator at a conditional release violation proceeding certainly has no more rights than a criminal defendant facing a capital murder charge like AAQI did.
Well, we're not worried about having no more. We're talking about whether they have as many.
And I guess I kind of went with that analysis because it's the only analysis we have really to the courts, and said that even under that analysis of AAQI, it's not met. He doesn't need the constitutional right to have an expert.
Do you believe that AAQI applies at the initial SVP stage?
Well, I think they're, of course, I mean, they have a statutory right to have an expert assistance.
That's not my question.
Right.
Does AAQI apply at the initial SVP stage?
I think he has due process protections. I mean, I guess if they did not have, hypothetically, if 37.2-907, which guarantees them a statutory right to an expert, was not there, then yes, I would think that at that proceeding in the trial phase where they're adjudicated to be a sexually violent predator, there would have to be some kind of due process protection, and I think the only thing we could look to at the trial phase would be the analysis in AAQI.
And then you say that the only due process that's required at the emergency custody proceeding is cross-examination. How do you make the distinction between the two?
Well,
AAQI applies to one and AAQI doesn't apply to the other. What's the analytical framework that would lead me to that conclusion?
Right. Well, at the trial phase is where they're being determined whether or not they are a sexually violent predator and then all the consequences that go along with that. At the conditional release violation hearing.
And what's the primary consequence? I'll answer that question. The primary consequence is I'm going to be deprived of my liberty. I'm already a felon. And now I'm going to be deprived of my liberty indefinitely. And at the emergency proceeding, I'm also going to be deprived of my liberty indefinitely. I don't understand where the line gets drawn, where AAQI applies to one and doesn't apply to the other. But that's your answer, and that's why I want to know what's the analytical framework that gets you there.
I think I ran out of time. If I can finish and answer your question,
please do.
That'd be fine. I think that would be
plenty of time to answer Justice Bibbs's question.
Okay. I think that would be the distinction then also between. I mean, this would be more analogous. The conditional release violation hearing would be more analogous to a probation violation hearing, where there's less protections applied to criminal defendants.
There's less, but there's still some.
Yes, and there's still protections here in the conditional release violation hearing, where the burden of proof is on the Commonwealth. The respondent has a counsel appointed. They have the right to cross-examine witnesses and have a hearing. So they still have due process protections at this proceeding. And although we talk about they're facing indefinite commitment, I mean, that means it could be that they're out in as little as a year or less. I mean, here in Thomas's case, he had a review hearing set in 9 months.
Could
and he had Dr. King appointed.
Could be that they're in for the rest of their lives.
And that also could be, but the burden to keep them there is still in the Commonwealth, because every year the Commonwealth still has to prove by clear and convincing evidence that they remain a sexually violent predator and that they're not suitable for conditional release, and that's due process.
My question is, what's the analytical framework that leads you to say that AAQI applies at the first stage but doesn't apply at some later stage?
Or
should we just presume, can we conclude that AAQI applies, that we have to look at AAQI no matter what stage we are?
Obviously, because there's no finding that AAQI applies to, criminal defendant at a probation violation hearing. So, I mean, although it might apply to the trial proceeding, not at a criminal probation violation hearing, and therefore I think there's a distinction between the sexual violent predator trial phase and the conditional release violation hearing.
Okay, I hear your answer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Under ACCA, there's three factors. There's private interest affected, that's the respondent's liberty. The second one's a government interest affected, that's a government argument, that's the money, the cost of experts. The third one is the probable value of an additional safeguards and the risk of erroneous deprivation of the private interest of the affected if not provided an expert. That's the Supreme Court said in ACCA. That issue is most predictably at its height when a respondent's mental condition is seriously in question. And that's what these cases are all about at every stage, the respondent's mental condition. That's why ACCA applies. That's why an indigent person needs assistance of an expert in these cases.
Why wouldn't the distinguishing factor between the initial determination and the review determination, which is actually a SVP determination as opposed to inpatient outpatient, why wouldn't that be the real ACCA issue? Why wouldn't that be the real tough call, actually? But we're not dealing with that. We're dealing with the interim, and I know there's some consternation about this, but this is a temporary proceeding. It's meant to be temporary. It's meant to be an emergency proceeding. It is very much like a TRO. You set things aside until you have an opportunity to flesh it all out. And a review hearing may be coming up in 6 months or 12 months or you're in 64 days. Well, we'll flesh it all out there. And then the ACCA question is pretty much on the table, which is if he can object to this expert and come up with a prima facie reason for not using him, shouldn't we pay for him to have his own? What's wrong? If that's my answer to your problem, what's wrong with my proper answer?
Because it's not a temporary resolution of an issue. It's subject to life incarceration of VCBR.
Okay, what am I missing then? I must be missing something in my question, because my question presupposes you get your expert, in theory, maybe, with ACCA, at the review hearing, where everything's back on the table. It's no longer do we need inpatient, outpatient. It is he a sexually violent predator at all anymore, or is he not anymore? Am I wrong? Tell me if I'm wrong. What exactly is the review proceeding meant to accomplish?
Whether there are conditions, well, first, whether he's a sexual predator.
Okay, stop right there. Do you ask that question in an emergency custody proceeding? No, you only ask one question. Does he need inpatient or outpatient?
Correct. As the statute's written, that's not an issue, whether he's an SVP. The issue is, has his mental state deteriorated that he needs to be put back in VCBR, or is he able to stay out with
whatever? Okay, so why wouldn't ACCA be arguably applicable to the original determination and every on-the-merits review determination, but not be applicable to an emergency proceeding where the only thing that's on the table is not his SVP status, but inpatient or outpatient?
No, ACCA still applies because the issue is more in-depth psychologically than inpatient versus outpatient. You get into also treatment facilities, the doctors opine about outpatient treatment issues, in this case, a drug addiction issue and how that affects his mental state. So it's not just quite should we put him back in or not, it's the mental makeup that is the requirement that needs to be considered and give an opinion to the court. And that's why ACCA still applies. Because that's whether he's an SVP at the initial stage, whether he ought to be released when he's incarcerated after being found an SVP, requires two doctors' opinions. And in this third stage, it doesn't, but I'm suggesting to the court that's unconstitutional because the issue at bottom is the same in every cycle. That's the psychological makeup. And doctors can give an opinion on what's available in the area, where the treatment program is available for him that can assess and resolve whatever that issue is that the Commonwealth is saying, putting him back into VCBR. There's a lot more than just, he suffers and he's an SVP that a psychologist brings to bear in assisting a respondent in these cases.
Thank you very much.
Your time has expired. The court will be in recess until 11:10.
All rise.